Hello and welcome to Heart Yoga Radio. We're off down the canal today. It's a bit squishy and a bit icy, so hopefully we won't be slipping on anything and falling on the canal. Although that could have comic value. Anyway, a long time ago, Pete introduced me to the phrase, following your own weird. And it's I've always found it actually very useful to revisit this phrase. So I was just gonna ask him today sort of where it comes from and what influence it had on him, which led him to pass it on to me.
Unfortunately, I didn't coin the phrase myself. I lifted it from Alan Watts.
Good old Alan,
yeah. Alan Watts is enjoying a bit of a resurgence at the moment. If you look at YouTube, there's loads of his talks, recorded talks and so forth. I think his books are still doing quite well. And yeah, I kind of came across the phrase in his works. I don't recall exactly where, possibly in what's his autobiography. It's an interesting read, actually. He had quite a life.
Yeah.
It's called Genuine Fake. So following your own weird. What is this? I think the term weird is spelt W-Y-R-D. It's not weird, you know, in W-I-E-R-D. But I'm sure the two words are related etymologically. And I suppose I think this is an old English word. Might even come from Anglo-Saxon or something like that. I'm not sure. But in modern parlance, we might say, following your bent. Following your own bent, which is equally charming.
Yeah.
Piece of English. And of course, Watts was a massive influence on the hippies in the 1960s. He became one himself. and hung around with that generation of beat poets and so forth, and he knew Krishnamurti, and he knew some of the Zen masters who had emigrated to California after the war, where they could ply their trade a little bit easier there than in Japan, which was under military occupation by the United States. Morning. And he knew Krishnamurti. And you know, Christmas Humphreys, who was a mover and shaker in British Buddhism.
That's a wonderful name.
Christmas Humphreys, yeah. I mean, he was an interesting character. He was a High Court judge. Christmas Humphreys.
Wow.
And a Buddhist. God. I don't think he came to Buddhism through theosophy. I mean, all of these connections are very, very interesting, and at some point might even be worth telling the story.
Yeah.
Of that generation of pioneers, I think.
Well, they did change the world in their own way,
yeah.
Didn't they?
Yeah, they did. But I am a bit of a fan of Watts, and I'm certainly a bit of a fan of the following your own weird, especially for artistic people. Now this in the hands of the hippies, this became do your own thing. And of course, in retrospect, that period, for me, is the way I understand it now, is that there was a sort of polarity between politicos. I was calling them like the Maoists, just as a catch-all phrase, because people actually took Chairman Mao a bit more seriously than perhaps they do now in the West, you know, Western intellectuals. On the one hand, and the hippies, who are called the hedonists, on the other hand, you know, there's like a political and a hedonistic wing. And then the personnel of these movements are overlapped, and people would drift between one and the other, you know, and hedonists would pay lip service to politics, and politicos would very often get religion at some point. When the political process seemed to be bankrupt, and well, they just got kind of warned off, you know, by violence, really, in some ways, perhaps. So I'm aware of all that, and do your own thing was condemned as individualistic, you know, as having no kind of sense of social movement, of civil rights and anti-war, and the hippies for their part said, well, it's, you know, the great refusal, you know, the true revolution is the great refusal. And of course, if the mob, I'm using that term not in a disrespectful way, the mobile vulgaris, decided they were just going to sit down and not go to work on Monday morning and start basket weaving or whatever. Actually, the world would change.
Yeah.
What if they just sat there and like meditated and said, "Oh, I really need to do this. I'm going to spend 3 years of my life staring at the wall." And if everybody did it, you would have a complete bloodless revolution. Yeah. So that was the naivety of the hippie view in some ways. And of course, that whole thing was kind of ended up getting paralysed by drugs and the revolt into style. You know, when Tin Pan Alley found they could sell the music for a great profit, a lot of which the musicians themselves wouldn't see in many cases.
Yeah.
Old story. You know, and the fashion and the colour and the carnivalesque aspect of hippie quickly turned into products that you could sell. And we're still seeing that roll down to the present day, some 50 years later, in the commodification of mindfulness and yoga and so forth,
yeah,
which are suddenly becoming products,
yeah,
on sale for profit. And the hippies know all this stuff, you know. They had a very instinctive and keen awareness of it. Anyway, Alan Watts, I would say, is like was a pioneer when he said, "Do your own, follow your own weird." And it is a very individualistic philosophy. Some of us don't have much choice but to live our lives that way. I certainly haven't.
Yeah, me neither.
But I've been a trade union representative, you know. I work in a voluntary capacity, an unpaid capacity for a yoga organisation. So I'm aware and.
Spent 20 years at the Maltins.
Oh, did you? Yeah. Because I was like, looking after disabled people and stuff, you know. So I'm not so militant and individualist as not to be aware of that stuff, and not to and involved in it. And obviously, as a philosopher, political philosophy, is a major concern for me. But nevertheless, follow your own weird. I haven't had any choice really. And Alan Watts certainly didn't seem to. And when he was kind of doing his hippie thing, he'd done various things. Watts, I think as a young man, I think he went to America basically to get out of military service. Is the impression I get. And he'd already written a book when he was just a teenager or in his early 20s. Forget the first book. But his first couple of books, he was very young when he wrote them. And so, you know, he came back living as an author. And at some point in all this, he became an Episcopalian priest, which is the American version of Anglicanism.
Why did he do that?
He just, I don't know, he felt, if his opinion, he felt the draw of Christianity, you know.
Right.
And it was much too stiff for him. I mean, he enjoyed the liturgy, which he said he treated as play, you know, as theatre and performance and play. And you could kind of wave the incense around, because the high church, you know, it's like bells and smells. And he really liked that for the fun of it. And this was even, you know, he was like an esteemed author on Buddhism. He's like an Anglican priest in America. Yeah. But it went pear-shaped for him. He wrote some books about his struggles. You know, it's documented his struggle with Christian theology, really. I think there's one called The Two Hands of God. And it's kind of agonising to read, to be honest. You need a strong stomach to read it. And an ability to press through dense text. And it's because the guy was struggling.
Yeah.
with the problem of evil. With the emphasis on guilt that certain readings of Christianity bring out. So he had a bit of struggle there. At the same time, his marriage was breaking up. I don't know which one. The guy was married 3 times and had loads of kids. And in the end, he did break away from the church. And you see pictures of him when he was a priest, Church of England priest, or Episcopalian priest, and he looked quite kind of stern, you know, and a bit straight. And then at some point after that, the hippies got him, or he got the hippies, or whatever. And he knew all this Huxley, and I think he knew Humphrey Osmond and people like that. Anyway, the upshot was that he had some psychedelic experience, the LSD, I think, and write a wonderful book about that, called The Joyous Cosmology, which is, in contrast to the Two Hands of God, it's wonderfully fluid. The writing just dances along. It's rapturous and without being exaggerated. And what came to his own as a writer on matters spiritual, you might say. You know, I always have to put quote marks around that word, but you know what I mean.
Yeah.
And of the utmost lucidity, I would say, and style and grace and art, and which emerged out of this crisis with faith, I think, you know, and with guilt and with monotheism, monotheistic religion, Judeo-Christian religion. Remember, this is a bloke with a lot of actually quite carefully worked out understanding of Buddhism and Hinduism and Taoism as well. You know, he actually did apply himself to that. Some people think he was too much of a popularizer and didn't really have any scholarship, but my research indicates that Watts actually did put his mind to it, you know. So it emerges from this crisis, this kind of bloke in a kaftan with long hair, beads, and a much more like relaxed face.
And was this the point where he came up with the follow your own weird
face? I think it was probably, I honestly don't know or recall, but it was probably towards the end of his life. He didn't live to a great age. Because he got all these kids. And there's three alimonies, presumably, to pay. He had to more or less tour incessantly towards the end of his life, selling his books and lecturing. He made good money on the American lecture circuit. And it was kind of pretty grueling, and he drank a lot, I think, to deal with it. And shagged a lot of women. Like, on the road scenario. So I can't remember how old he was when he died. I think he was in his 50s, you know. Because he was a bit... He was a bon vivant as well. You know, certainly nothing puritanical about him. And at the end of his life, he described himself as a Taoist, and he wrote the great book, The Watercourse Way, which he didn't quite finish. And again, that's a wonderfully luminous book. Very poetic and flowing. And just puts over the core concepts of Lao Tzu and Chang Tzu. Again, with this amazing lucidity. And you can see this is a man who followed his own weird, you know. He'd been through quite a lot of metamorphoses.
Yeah.
But because he created and expressed as he was going, we have all these various phases documented in his books, you know, from the early slightly young mannish works on Zen and so forth, which are nevertheless very good. I would say there is real understanding there. You can tell they're written by a young man, a callow. But I'm a callow young man, yeah. He wasn't that callow, though. He'd got it up there. But you can tell, through the Anglican scenario and the tension and convolution of that, of getting drawn into the labyrinth of theology, through to the lucidity and freedom, I would say, of his lighter Deist, post-LSD, itself. There's a man who followed his own word, W-Y-R-D, and it's following your bent. And he recommended it. He recommended it. I mean, if you go on YouTube, you can find lectures where what he's saying. You know, dig your heels and do what you want. Don't hurt anybody else, I would say. It's what I'd add to that. Yeah. As long as you're not hurting anybody else, do what you want. If the powers that be don't like you, and they've got the power, if you're living in an authoritarian society, you have to go into the shadows a little bit, or into the interstices and the back alleys of life. But nevertheless, still do it. Nevertheless, still do it.
Did he mention what the consequences would be if you didn't follow your own word, when really you needed to?
Well, I'm not sure the chapter and verse. As I say, you sprang this question on me, you know. But I would say...
Yeah, this is a completely spontaneous talk, by the way.
Yeah. I mean, it's not meant to be like a talk about Alan Watts, but of course, you know, since the guy coined the term, the story of his life kind of illustrates it, you know. The consequences of not doing it.
Because I have an idea of what those consequences are, because I've experimented with doing it and not doing it myself. But I just wondered if Alan himself had anything to say on that subject.
I think I kind of vaguely recall him saying, even with some of these talks, which are now coming to light, recorded talks, saying stuff like, well, you know, he kind of said, you know, be bold and mighty forces will come to your aid.
A la
Goethe, you know. He said, you'll be all right, don't worry so much. And he was quite condemnatory of the plastic lifestyles, what the hippies called normal people who followed the American dream, you know, the car on hire purchase and the kitchen full of gadgets, you know.
The muggles,
if you like. Or if you watch Far From Heaven, you know, the 50s American dream. And He regarded that as like living death, you know, from what I can see.
Well, and that film actually does very perfectly portray that.
Yeah, it's very powerful.
If you ever want to experience some living death, watch Far From Heaven.
Yeah, I know, it is
a brilliant film, though.
It's a masterpiece, yeah. So he was quite sneery about all that. And he kind of said, well, the consequences of doing it are that, you know, if you kind of you relax and you don't worry too much, you'll be okay. You know, you can do it. Is what he's saying. You can do it. Now, I would say, this is me. You know, if you have a strong drive, if there's something that's trying to express itself through your character, your genetic inheritance, and your peculiar and totally unique biography. And it does have a lot of energy behind it, and an imperative and an urgency to express itself. And you don't, it'll make you ill.
Yeah.
It'll drive you crazy. How much craziness is caused by the frustration of a talent?
Yeah.
You know, and it might even not be a talent. It might even be you're not that good at playing the piano. But if you don't do it, you're going to go crackers. You know, and you've got to explore it and find your way through.
Because it's an unexpressed passion.
Yeah, and I think, of course, not everybody has it. You know, if it's not very strong in you, you might well be better off with a 9-to-5. If you can find such a thing these days. Of course, bear in mind, there's all this stuff, you know, that the 9-to-5 is disappearing. The American dream, or if you like, the British suburban dream, are rapidly disappearing under the force of automation, export of labour through globalisation, cheap labour economies and so on. They're not even an option anymore. There's actually like more and more openings to follow your own word as times get more difficult. It's starting to get more difficult. It's quite interesting.
Because there's more cracks.
There's more cracks, gaps, interstices.
That you can work into, and more shadows that you can slide into. So that
you can be more open. You can be more open about it now as well.
Yeah.
We have the internet.
Yeah.
Okay, it's a two-ended stick, as I keep saying.
I know.
But it is potentially a force for liberation. There's many, many more opportunities now. And more imperatives, greater, stronger imperatives. But my thing is, if you do have it very strongly, you have to just go and try and be an artist, or a philosopher, or a kung fu expert, or a yogi, or whatever it is, and give it your all. And I've certainly been quite unable to do otherwise, personally. I mean, I've tried. I've tried to be a model citizen and straight, you know. I think I might even cut my hair once, you know. Do it like that. But you just feel ill.
Yeah.
You just feel ill, you know. And, but I think he probably is. It's a certain type of person. But I think they're more plentiful than perhaps we recognise. And we'll see, I would think, now.
Yeah.
Now, jobs, you know. Regular employment, as previously understood, is disappearing. I'm talking about 50% of jobs disappearing by 2030. It's 17 now, isn't it? You know, that's 13 years away, you know. Again, the automation of white collar.
Yeah.
I mean, it creates all sorts of problems, because if people are not employed, they've got no money to spend. So they have a low-demand economy, which is what we've got. It's not the only problem that's causing the economic instability that we've got, but it's one of the big ones. So I have to find a way of giving people money to spend, you know, or the ability to consume somehow, which might not be through money, might be through the microchip in your neck, you know, do you see what I mean? But because of the hippies and Alan Watts and the example of people like Allen Ginsberg and Gary Snyder, people who followed their own weird all their lives and had full and rich lives and left a legacy of poetry or literature or teaching, maybe even sometimes of science and technology. I mean, look at the number of independent minded people who've made scientific and technological breakthroughs, either on the level of, you know, of high theory, or on the level of business innovation, you know, like the early Silicon Valley people. These are very original people who followed their own way, and it can apply in any part of life, I would say.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. I was reading a little book somebody gave me called The Discovery of the Germ.
Oh, yes.
It's one of our toilet books, isn't it? That you read in the bath or while you're kind of doing your ablutions.
Yeah.
I'm now in about my third reading of that book.
Yeah.
But it's totally fascinating. And all these bloody-minded scientists who followed their own weird.
Yeah. And were just extremely passionate about what they were doing. Yeah. They're determined to do it, even though the opposition from people in their own field was so strong.
Absolutely.
And they were just destroyed personally.
Yeah. And sometimes some of these individuals didn't rise to the moral challenge, you know. They would sometimes cheat or behave in underhanded ways towards their rivals. I mean, Isaac Newton was absolutely awful to Robert Hooke, who was a genius as well, you know, and he just made the bloke's life a misery. And he got this terrible feud with Leibniz over who was the first one to develop the differential calculus. And he was an extremely unpleasant character, you know. He followed his own way.
Yeah.
It's not necessarily a path of virtue.
No.
And people kind of, you know, people are people. But nevertheless, that kind of thing to push through, that kind of bit of bloody-mindedness, goes a long way. And the word weird, you know, you can hear it in the word that. Well, to my mind, the way my mind works with words, they conjure up whole kind of patterns of connotation, you know,
and
pictures. And weird W-Y-I-R-D.
I do love that.
Weird.
Yeah.
You know, in a kind of Anglo-Saxon accent, whatever that would be like. You just get a sense of the labyrinthine twists and turns that you take when you do this.
Yeah.
And the blind alleys you go up and all the rest of it.
And the surprises and the unexpected things that can pop up.
And again, what's his life? It's all there in what's his life, you know. The escape, the stultifying life of the British upper middle class, and the possibility of military service, and getting involved in a stupid war. And it did take some twists and turns, and I'd say no, I'm not so far off my 80. I can look back and say the same, you know. And thank God for the hippies, you know. Because now we need to know that this can be done.
Yeah.
And some people have done it for a lifetime and documented it. And that is liberating knowledge.
Yeah.
That's why, especially now, as people have been thrown into a kind of enforced leisure, possibly. You know. Either that or into some kind of like Mad Max post-apocalypse scenario in which, well, you're going to need every kind of skill you can get, and everybody needs to be developing what they do, what they can do and what they love really, really well to the highest degree, if that kind of post-apocalyptic society is going to develop into something, if human beings are going to survive, basically, you know.
So for me, when you introduced me to this phrase, first of all, a little light bulb went on in my head, and I realised this is what I'd been doing all along anyway. But over the years, when life feels quite constraining, as it sometimes does, and you have to be more regimented in what you do to be able to accomplish the necessary tasks, you can get a little bit stuck in that and find yourself still having a regimented frame of mind when you actually don't need to anymore. And that phrase is just, again, just little, it's just echoed through my head, and I've gone, oh yes.
Yeah.
And I've noticed that for me, and not a prescription for everybody, but for me, when I'm not following my own weird, or at least I cannot follow it for a while when necessary, which I think is good. But if I do that for too long, I do what you were describing early on, where I do start to feel unbalanced and eventually start to feel ill.
Yeah.
And this unexpressed part of myself becomes crystallized. It stops moving, stops flowing, my energy stops flowing, so I get tired.
Yeah.
And all the sparkle goes out of life.
Yeah.
And it's a bit like, oh, why bother?
Yeah.
But then sometimes when I'm feeling like that, I remember, that's why I'm not following my own weird properly. And then I get back into it. And I noticed there's all these opportunities for the weird to be followed at every moment.
Yeah.
And then I start following them, and life starts unfolding in a much more interesting, vibrant way.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And then I'm alive again.
Oh. There's actually, in the Gnostic Gospel, just to go somewhere completely different, and now for something completely different. Except it's not. It's not relevant. There's these suppressed books that were suppressed by the Council of Chalcedon in, I don't know, the very early history of the Christian Church, which said that there are only four legitimate Gospels, you know, Matthew, Mark, Luke and John. But actually, at that time, Christian mystics and hermits were using a whole range of documents contemporary with the Synoptic Gospels, like the Gospel of Thomas, the Gospel of Mary Magdalene, and so forth. And Irenaeus was sent to Upper Egypt to stop these guys from using these books, and said, you've got to burn them. the park's decided and the committee. The committee.
Yeah.
The committee has decided that there's only these four. You've got to stop using these kind of bloody these Gnostic, so-called Gnostic gospels. So, but instead of burning them, they hid them in jars, in caves, and they came to light in the 20th century, quite late. And I think some of these documents are owned by the Bollingen Foundation, which arose out of the work of Jung, C.J. Jung. And you can see them on the internet, photographed, you know, you can see. And anyway, there's one called, I think called Sayings of Jesus. I mean, it's been such a long time since I inquired into this. So, please, you know, don't take it as chapter and verse is 100% authoritative accurate, but it's somewhere in that corpus, possibly in the Sayings of Jesus, that there's this saying where Jesus says, he who brings forth that which is inside him will flourish and see the light. And he, or she, who doesn't bring forth what is inside him will perish.
Mm.
You know, it's like, that's quite a good authority, you know, your argument from authority. Jesus says do it. That's why you got like, there was like a famous hippie song. I can't even remember who sang it, but it was like, Jesus, his trip's all right with me.
Yeah.
You know, some kind of hippie, like giving the swirly guitar, you know. Jesus, his trip's all right with me. Jesus. So, that is possibly what they were alluding to. If not, that is what they should have been alluding to.
Yeah.
Follow your weird, especially if it's burning inside you, you know.
Well, yeah, because otherwise it'll just burn you up.
It will, yeah. I mean, if you're not one of them people, you know, you're quite happy. You're doing your data entry job, or slowly being replaced by a robot at the Amazon warehouse. Don't bother, you know, because it probably isn't for everyone.
Yeah, and if you try and force yourself to follow your own weird when you don't really have a weird to follow, yeah, that will mess you up too.
Possibly, yeah. I don't know any people who ain't got a weird, to be honest, so we're probably kind of...
Yeah. We're personally, I think that deep inside everyone there is always a weird, but...
There is, yeah. I mean, it's an age when you kind of look back quite a lot, you know. I certainly think, I can see all these tensions operating in the life of my mother and my father, you know. They're like working class, and their siblings and so forth. And in my grandfather, you know. I mean, my grandfather must have been had quite a constrained life as a working class man born in the 1870s. But he followed his weird. He followed his weird, you know.
Yeah.
Football and allotments.
Yeah.
And with a passion. And the man's in his 70s, digging through allotments,
yeah,
producing this wonderful stuff. He's there at 6 o'clock in the morning, singing and whistling and working.
It's not the weird, isn't about what you do, it's about how you do it and the attitude in which you undertake it.
Yeah, and it's about the fact that you let it happen, that you let it happen in your life, and you give it priority.
Yeah.
You give it a very, very high priority.
So it's like the sentence, following your weird. So instead of imposing the weird,
no, you don't find
perhaps you, because you've listened to this, you think, oh God, Anna and Pete said I should have a weird. I'm going to be very anxious about that now and try and make a weird for myself and force myself to have one.
Your weird.
That's not what we're saying.
Your weird might be to stare at the back of your eyelids or to sit on the side of the river with your fishing rod.
Or to make sandcastles.
Yeah.
Or to study ducks.
Yeah.
It could be anything. Oh.
Well, you just stare at the back of your eyelids.
Yeah, yeah.
Anyway, we're getting up towards town now.
Okay, so I hope that's useful. There's been a lot of water sounds in the background, so I hope that's not too loud for everybody, because all the...
It's the water course way,
it's
mate.
The locks are filling up quite forcefully. There's a lot of water coming down, so that's the noise that you've been hearing. Anyway... I hope you enjoyed that and useful for some, hopefully, and we'll speak to you soon.
Yeah. So Anna followed her weird this morning.
Oh yes, that's
and,
right.
sprang the question on me of the weird.
Yeah.
So that's where we're up to.
Yeah. It was a spontaneous moment I felt would be fruitful.
Okay, bye bye.
Bye bye, folks. That's all.